No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype questions to BBSRADIOPR. Now, I have to apologize to our listeners because we've been giving out the wrong Skype address for a while. So please note that the Skype address is BBSRADIOPR. Tonight, we've just got a fascinating show. We have the best guest we've ever had. So let's welcome Maria. I have a few things to say before we start our interview. But first, let me welcome my co-host Maria Sanchez. How are you, Maria?
I'm well. Thank you, Michael. Thank you so much. It's such a treat and a privilege and an honor to be here with you every week.
Oh my gosh, you're so sweet. And let me just say before we get started, and what we're going to do tonight is we're going to interview Maria because she's like incredibly fascinating as a human being, and I think our listeners really need to know about her more than what they've just heard in our weekly exchange here. But first, I have to give a big shout out to another woman who I admire and adore, and that is Tulsi Gabbard. Tulsi is a representative from Hawaii, and she is the latest co-sponsor on our statehood
bill. My goodness.
Yeah. And
what are you at now with numbers?
We're at 158 in the House and 22 in the Senate still, but 158 in the House. And the nice thing about this woman is that she's from Hawaii, and Hawaii has been so supportive of statehood. Even their state legislature, without any prodding or anything, the year before last, passed a resolution in support of DC statehood. I don't think anybody even asked them to do it. They just did it.
Wow.
And that's amazing. And, you know, maybe it's because they are, in fact, the 50th state. A lot of people think that Hawaii and Alaska came in together, but actually, I mean, they did sort of, but actually, Alaska came in January 1959 and Hawaii came in August. So Alaska is the 49th state and Hawaii is the last state, the 50th state.
And so, what is the population of Hawaii?
I don't know off the top of my head, but I would doubt it.
I'm wondering if it's similar to the District of Columbia.
Well, we're only bigger than two states, and there are three other states that we're close to in population, but I don't think Hawaii is one of them. We're bigger than Vermont and Wyoming. We used to be bigger than seven states because at one time the population of the District of Columbia was 850,000, and now it's 700,000, and it's grown dramatically in the last 5 years. I mean, I think that 10 years ago, you know, we were 500 and some thousand. So it dropped precipitously for a while. And, you know, that urban flight.
And affordability or the lack thereof.
And, you know, and so now it's growing substantially. But, and we have tons of millennials, maybe because if you move into the district, you need two incomes and no children to be able to afford to live here. It's not easy.
And Hawaii has almost 1.5 million people. So, yeah.
1.5 million. So they have about twice as many as we do.
Yes.
And, what just a wonderful place. I know you've been there, Maria, and I've been there several times and just love it. But tonight, we're here to talk about Maria Sanchez. And before we start, before I ask Maria any questions, I want to tell you a few things about how our relationship started. When I started this show with a dear, dear friend of mine, Kathleen Gomez, who used to be the co-host, I wanted so much to make it a show where it wasn't just one more liberal talking head interviewing people and talking about our problems in DC and, you know, our attempt to get statehood. I wanted it to be something where we had a diverse set of opinions and we would attract people to come on the show who had diverse sets of opinions so that maybe we could start a conversation with America. And in that regard, I can't even remember how we found Maria, but we found Maria and we knew she was a Republican woman from the West Coast. You know, here we were from the East Coast and we had her on the show and she was just amazing. She was an amazing guest. And when Kathleen had to leave the show because she went to work for lobbyists, I went in search of somebody to help me with the show. And the first person I asked was Maria, with the hope that she would be on occasionally and help me. And she volunteered to be on every week. And it's like the greatest thing that could have happened to this show. She's brought such a level of professionalism and she's really increased, we're getting a much larger listening audience today than we had before. And she's just really, really been a major force in making that happen. So I'm so happy that she's my co-host and I respect her so much. But I also find her incredibly fascinating. This woman was, she had her own radio show for many years. Here she is working on a PhD in media psychology, which we're going to talk about because I have no idea what media psychology is. And I'm sure that our listeners don't either. But yeah, a mother who used to ride a Harley, who, was the executive producer of a sitcom. We go on and on and on, and I'm not sure that an hour's going to cover it, but let's start. What is media psychology?
So, by the way, I'm humbled and grateful and really amazed at your thoughtful introduction. So thank you, Michael, because I actually was a guest twice on your program.
Uh-huh.
And I remember both you and Kathleen saying, wow, you're reasonable. You're like,
right.
Not only are you moderate, you're liberal and all kinds of other avenues. And I am guilty. Yes. And you and I talk about this a lot, about how titles define those people that we think we know who them to be because of what they say or ascribe to. Yeah. But the truth is, at the end of the day, what we have more in common is our human experience. And as we've discussed too, Michael, what you and I agree on is about 85% of the issues. And so it's the minimum margin that we disagree on. And yet that's what seems to be the focus of the coverage and the politics and the partisanship and the two-party system and all of that, which I think you and I are helping to dispel a bit.
I hope. Yeah, and I think we're trying to do that, and I think you're absolutely right. You know, when we talk about the hot button issues, I think you're right. We talk about those little things in the margins because, I think we're all proud to be Americans. For example, there's things that people never say. When have you ever heard somebody say, oh, I'm so sorry I was born in this country. I wish I was, I mean, there are basic things that we all agree on, that this is a great country, that, we have great freedom and liberty, and you know, we can be what we want, and our children can have a better life than we had. And you know, I think there's a lot to be said for the commonality that exists in America. And I think you're right. It just gets obscured by that little stuff in the margins.
So I cut my talk radio teeth in Los Angeles at the largest 50,000 watt station with the time spent listening and the cumulative audience, which was this behemoth still today known as KFI radio. And KFI launched, or syndicated Rush Limbaugh launched, these stalwarts that heritage folks that we are still on the air today, Dr. Laura also. And I learned from them that, as you said, Michael, politics is what most of radio has been devoted to, but the truth is 95% of the rest of our life is devoted to balancing our budget, making ends meet, being in a relationship, having a family, and taking care of business in our community. And so that's what I always focus my radio program on: current events, lifestyle, health, relationships, but not necessarily politics, unless Elliot Spitzer was caught with a prostitute, or Arnold Schwarzenegger fathered a child, you know, with the housekeeper, right, or what have you. So unfortunately, it doesn't lead with bleed, and therefore it's not polarizing and it's not controversial, unlike the other folks that I aforementioned. And I even launched an internet television program daily that was only about good news, and we couldn't get any advertisers because nobody cares about good news.
Yeah,
they want
to
hear about what's sensational. So therefore then I realized 10 years ago that what I was trying to do on terrestrial radio wasn't consumable. You know, it's a black and white world, right? It's the bottom line is profit and shareholders and everything else. And just do what I love to do, which is broadcasting. And so you have helped me keep my toe in that water, because we're relevant and we're also historical because of what we're doing. But we're today and topical.
Well, you know, I just think, again, you've just added such a professional touch to this show, you know, because basically we went at it with a really good heart, but that was it. We had no experience. We didn't know what we were doing. And you know, I think you brought so much to the show. So I so much appreciate that. And maybe that's one of the reasons that we have such a good fit, Maria, is because I represent ideas that really aren't that controversial, you know, that the people of my city should have the same rights that everybody else has. 80% of Americans agree with that. So it's not really, you know, I'm not one of those guys that's out there screaming about one particular issue or you know, trying to be polarizing. Most of what I want to talk about is the middle ground, because I think, you know, as we both said so far, there's a lot of middle ground. So,
what you bring to the program, which I also really admire, and it's not the lens that I look at life through, is you always talk about public service and public policy and precedence. So when you and I are speaking with a guest, I come from this, tell me what it's like, an Oprah Winfrey, a Terry Gross kind of journalistic approach. And then you take it to this, well, how can we make that better or different, or how can we change policy? Or in other words, you take it from the political lens, which sometimes people think that is pejorative, but I see it as serving the higher good.
Well, you know, I've got to tell you that if there's a handful of rules that I live by, one is, you know, what Al Einstein taught me, that what you see depends on where you stand. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm constantly trying to look at other people's positions and trying to figure out new positions for myself, because I think that changes your perspective on everything. And And I think that's a way to find the common ground. You know, somebody, I was interviewed this week, and somebody asked me about a situation here, the controversial situation that involved some remarks that were made about anti-Semitic remarks and the tension between these two groups of people. And I said, you know, when I think, and I was thinking about Republicans, actually, I said, when I think of Republicans and that label's put on somebody, the first thing I do is think about all the Republicans in my life that I love. You know, I don't like Donald Trump. I don't agree with Donald Trump, but I have family members that voted for him. Mm-hmm. People that I care about and I love. So I don't say I'm not that liberal Democrat that says Republicans that voted for Trump are evil, because I know Republicans that voted for Trump and they are not evil. They're good, honest, stand up people. And so that's what I try to do. I try to think of those people. And I hope our show makes people do that a little bit more, because I think that would really help. And I know that's the way you are, too. And
humanizing,
and from our right, and we all come from our experience, and your experience, you know, you have great experience, and some of that experience is being a mom. You know, how can you be a parent? I mean, I experienced this as a father. It's even more intense as a mother. But how can you be a parent and not care about the state of the world? You know,
so interestingly enough, I was raised by my parents, who were married for 63 years until my father's passing, that were always philanthropic. They always were giving, donating, most importantly, contributing in with their time, treasure, and talent, and leading. And so, therefore, I've never not volunteered, rolled up my sleeves, donated, what have you. Not for any reason other than, if I can help, why wouldn't I? And isn't that what philanthropy is all about?
Yes. And you know what? A lot of the people that never do a damn thing for anybody else are the people that complain the most, too. I mean, you know that when you start to do for other people and you start to do in your community, what it does is it breeds more of that behavior. Not only in other people, but also in you, right? You know, if you look back at your life, I'm sure you'll see the same pattern that I see, that, oh, I volunteered for this, and I volunteered for that, and then I volunteered for this, you know, which is one of the reasons that we want to encourage volunteerism, because it begets more volunteerism.
So you know, but I have to ask you some stuff. Thought about that, though, Michael.
Well,
an upward spiral, if you will.
Yeah,
like I've been honored. I've gone to Senegal and I dug a well for women of a village to give them water for 12 months of the year instead of just for what the holes are filled with during the monsoon. So that empowered the women to raise crops year round, which gave them more economic advantage, which actually upset the apple cart within their polygamous society. But we also dealt with the men and talked to them about how this was, you know, for the common good. And then I dispensed the polio vaccine in India on behalf of Rotary to eradicate polio, which is now only in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Nigeria. And that's mostly due to politics, unfortunately. But we're down to 300 cases a year as opposed to 350,000 cases a year. So it's going to be the second disease behind smallpox that's ever been eradicated from the planet. And I will never forget those moments. I stayed at the home of a Sikh and his wife and their children, and Muslim, and beautiful, wonderful, engaging, amazing hosts. And that was also part of I did this with the American Red Cross too. I've been a volunteer and was deployed to disasters and spoke with news agencies to let them know what the American Red Cross response is like, Tuscaloosa in particular. It's a privilege to be able to give, and it is of benefit to everyone concerned.
Well, and that therein lies the incentive to do more of it too, right? Personally, I mean, I've always felt that too. I worked with my kids for 10 years at a homeless shelter feeding women once a month. And the main reason that we did that was to, so our children would have some sense of how, you know, of giving back to the community and how lucky they were and helping people less advantaged. But what you get out of it, too, you know, as an externality, I guess, that you, maybe you don't count on, is you get a great feeling in feeding a hungry person. It feels great to feed a hungry person, right? You feel like you've done something really positive. And the things you've talked about, how amazing is that? That you bring, you know, something as simple as water, but as so important as to the life style of these people.
Whom live, if they're lucky, in corrugated tin roof homes with no windows, just holes, and no flooring, just dirt.
And also another externality that you talk about is, you know, that you were housed with a lovely Sikh family.
Yes.
Now I, you know, this is what I was just talking about. When I think of Muslims, I think of Osmia. Osmia was someone who worked for my wife and I for years, and she helped raise our children, and her family is like our family. You know what I mean? And we should give a shout out to her lovely daughter, who's just said Osmia has just become a grandmother.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. She just,
congratulations.
Yes, her daughter just had a beautiful little boy. But you know, that's who I think of when I think of Muslims. You know, I think of this wonderful woman who we love like she's a member of our family, and mm-hmm. her children and her husband. You know, so that's another byproduct of doing good work in the world, right?
Well, you see people for who they are.
Yeah, right. You really do.
And my daughter's live-in boyfriend is Muslim. He's from Turkey. And mm-hmm. that's a is he a good man? Does he treat you well? Is he kind? Is he generous? Is he thoughtful? Is he loving? Yep. Okay. Who cares? Yeah. Whatever else comes behind that. Today's his birthday, by the way.
happy birthday.
Yeah. And she took him to Kona, his first trip to Hawaii. So, and she sent me a text. It was the sweetest thing, Michael. And she wanted to know if this was a proper sentence. She wanted to send it to him to let him know what she thinks about him. And she said, "You're the most kindest, hardworking, and generous human I know."
Well, whether that's grammatically correct or not, I'd love somebody to say that to me.
She said, "Is this a proper sentence?" And I said, "Yes, it is, and it is oh so sweet." And then she sent me a picture of the two of them with, you know, with the ocean behind them. It's like, and he's a Muslim. Whatever. So what? Does he love her the way she should be loved? Does he care for her the way she should be cared for? Does she feel the way she should feel? Yeah. All right. That's what matters.
Yeah, of course. This was
not labels, not titles.
Right. And, you know, and how we pray. I mean, how silly is that? And isn't that one of the oldest conflicts on the planet? You know, that I just remember one of my favorite books was Gulliver's Travels, and that's, you know, they go to war in Gulliver's Travels because one country cracks the eggs in the middle and the other cracks the eggs at the top. You know what I mean? The soft boiled eggs, and it makes
like that's
the point
a deal breaker.
Yeah, but it makes the point at what. You know, is it any less ridiculous to go to war over the fact that you pray three times a day or you pray once a day, or that you pray in a mosque or you pray in a church five times a day? Yeah, that's how much I know, you know, but does that really, is it any less ridiculous to fight over those things? I think not. I think that some of the things that have divided the world over the years are just, you know, just as ridiculous as that. So,
but along those lines, Michael, because you alluded to that in the introduction, I went to the major fundraising gala for the cancer support community as the guest of the outgoing CEO. And it's what makes it all possible, with everything being given for people who have cancer, who love someone who has cancer, who takes care of someone who has cancer, who's a product of someone who has cancer, for free. And that whole altruism and thinking of others to help the one of the keynote speakers, well, we honored her, 13 years with pancreatic cancer.
That's
do
incredible.
You know what an outlier that is?
Yes, I do, and because
it's
I knew someone.
Two other times.
Yeah.
It's metastasized two other times.
That is
and
a
she
real
was
outlier.
Honored last night. And so there are these miracles, and it does matter, and it does change. And every one person has an opportunity to affect that, be the agent of change.
Absolutely.
And that's what you do with public service. And now that's what I'm doing with my reinventing myself through my education, because I started my master's degree in between child 3 and 4. And then a subsequent relocation and a divorce and a career in talk radio prevented me from completing that. So last year I graduated with my master's in clinical psychology, emphasis marriage family therapy. And then in January I started my journey on my PhD in this field known as media psychology, which you also mentioned, which is the only one in the country. There's 3 in the world, 1 in Germany and 1 in the UK and the 1 in the United States. And what media psychology is at the bottom is psychology, but it's about the interaction of our behavior as human beings and media and technology, which is all we do anymore.
And so, and, okay. So give me an example of what you, you know, what a case study would be for you, or what a, you know, or once you have your doctorate in this subject, what you would do.
So in any PhD pursuit, it's about expanding the knowledge of what we know today. So if you're just regurgitating, well, anybody can do that, even a journalist, you know, you read a study and then you say, this is what it says
right
today. So what we're challenged to do is take what's known and then open it up. So, for example, I had 3 final projects. One was on the phenomenon known as female genital mutilation. The other one was about a woman who was born and raised in Calcutta and was educated by Mother Teresa, who came to the United States, got her advanced degrees, and went back there to found a home that and a school system that keeps the girls from being sold to sex trafficking by their mothers for as little as $40 at the age of 7. And she's taking them and educating them and educating their mothers and their fathers. And she's making a difference one-on-one. And so those are the arenas that and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation that is eradicating polio. And so I took the media that they have and then did the research about the phenomenon and then wrote a paper about what is known and what needs to be known, and then produced a media piece to accompany it. So it's, and every time they said a media piece, I was like, oh, I already wrote about that. I wrote 14 pages. And there was like, yes, but your degree is in media psychology.
Right.
And transmedia, which is artificial intelligence, artificial reality, virtual reality, social media, and everything else that you touch that's electronic. Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, Instagram.
Well, in a lot of ways, this must be a new frontier.
Absolutely.
Because of the the expansion of all these technologies that you talk about.
Absolutely.
I mean, look, I don't want to digress here, but I lease a car for 3 years, and my lease is just about up. So it's up in a couple of days. So I went to the car dealer and looked at the new model to lease, and I can't believe the technology that has increased just in the last 3 years.
You're kidding.
Oh, no, this model has all sorts of things that were expensive options maybe
back in the day.
Yeah, not that they didn't exist, but they were expensive options. Now they're standard, you know. Cross, when people cross in front of you, technology, blind spot technology, backup technology, all sorts of crazy things. And You know, these fields are just, or this, I think we're really in the infancy, for example, of the internet. I mean, what the internet will be 50 years from now, if it still exists, it may be replaced by something else. I don't know. But
that was my other final project was asking that before you get onto www. That you are required to go into a portal that is a primer in digital literacy and that you ascribe and adhere to no profanity, nothing illegal, no cyberbullying, no defamation of character, no hiding behind an avatar, no being anonymous, that this is what we agree to by going onto the internet. And then when you get on the internet, if you do those things, you know that you shouldn't, or you know that it's wrong, or you know that it's bad. Because right now, the title of my piece was called The Wild, Wild West of the Internet.
Yeah, right.
Because none of that is asked for. And people said, well, you're giving away your rights, your amendment rights. And I was like, no. Every time you go to anything, they ask you to agree to the terms and conditions thereof. Why shouldn't the internet be any different?
Right.
Just because it's available doesn't mean that, and it's free, doesn't mean that you should be able to do anything.
Well, you know, Mrs. Brown, my wife, is a middle school librarian. So this is a constant, you know, this is a constant problem for her because she ends up trying to be the gatekeeper for middle school kids who are using the internet. And because it's such a wild, wild west kind of environment, it's hard for her. You know, she's constantly policing things and trying to help kids find their way and making sure they're not getting into the wrong areas on the internet. Right.
Because I hear if you Google White House, it takes you to a porn site.
Well, yeah. I mean, there are, you know, I have people today sending me emails that want proprietary information because, you know, I mean, obvious scams every day on the internet that I see. And you know what? I'm 64 years old. If you're 17 years old or 14 years old or 12 years old, are you able to detect the scams as well?
Right.
I think not.
Right.
And I'm also from New Jersey, whose state motto is "We shall not be scammed." But you know, so I've been around the block a few times, really, and that concerns me. I wonder about kids getting lured into the wrong places, and you know, we should have more rules.
It's so easy.
Yeah.
Right. And especially if you don't put the parental controls in, which I know you can. And you could also suggest that that's a violation of rights or whatever. But what I was stating in my final project was, let's just have a common understanding about how we conduct business, much like that octangular red sign that we all agree to stop our vehicles at.
Yeah.
That's an understanding and a consensus. Nobody's dictating. We just said, yes, that means that stop, just like the red light means stop. Your rights aren't being denied. There's just an agreement that we're going to behave accordingly. But the internet has never established that. And one of my professors was like, well, Maria, it's like, what do they call it? Closing the gate after the horse already left or whatever.
That's the barn, right?
Right. But I'm like, well, if we don't begin now, what about the next generation and the next generation? Like, can't we establish some? Just so you know, Michael, we don't have any ethics here in the United States about artificial intelligence. Europe has agreed to and is implementing it on May 1st of this year, next month, in the next few days, about what is and is not appropriate with the use of artificial intelligence.
Well, and look at Stephen Hawking. Wasn't this his final message to beware of artificial intelligence?
Yes. Elon Musk said we should be very, very afraid. And the more I know, the more I agree. And my professor said to me, what are you afraid of? And I said, there aren't any ethics in place. And he said, you should be afraid.
Yeah,
yes, you're correct.
You know, but we all read 1984, all us hippies anyway, read 1984, and we understand what can happen if a handful of people get to control everything. Yeah.
But here we're talking about the people. In other words, this is the people have agreed to this.
Yes.
But we in the United States haven't agreed to it. It's called GDPR. And what they have said is that this is what we should adhere to. And then I guess you could also say if people don't, then that's why they could be prosecuted, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm not even talking about that. I'm just saying this is how you play the game. This is how you play hopscotch, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is how you play chess. This is how you play backgammon. This is how you play whatever. So when you get on the internet, this is what you do.
Well, and the rules are in place. You know, obviously, you know, you have to make the connection with people that they're in there for your own safety or your own good for some reason. You stop at the stop sign so everybody doesn't crash into each other when the four of you come to the same intersection.
Right.
I mean, there's an element of self-preservation in your motivation to stop at the stop sign. And there should be, as far as the internet goes too, that you know, it's a matter of preservation for all of us. And I think we have a problem with this in a lot of areas in our lives. You know, it's back to what you were talking about, the little marginal part of the issues. You know, we see it in issues like gun control, where there are plenty of people, you and I have talked about this before, plenty of people in the world that think you have every right to own a firearm, you know, but we want to draw some boundaries to make it safer. And where those boundaries are depends on who you talk to, you know. And that's really the issue, right, is where you draw them. So that gray area is so important in everything to define that area.
So ordinarily what they say, what goes on in California sweeps east.
Uh-huh.
You know, from integration to interracial marriages to gay rights to whatever, which I'm really proud of. I love that part about California being so liberal in that regard. They're saying that this general data protection regulation, which is being implemented next month, might actually affect us in the United States because it's about privacy. Mm-hmm. And it's setting a new standard for that. So it says that companies cannot collect or gather our data unless they have our consent.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas before, well, now in the United, even I did a paper on this too, these wearable technology, the Fitbits and stuff that people put on their arms, that information about your blood pressure, your cholesterol, how much you slept, how much was REM sleep, how active you were, how many steps you took, all of that goes back to the originator of the technology.
Yeah.
That's your information. That's their information.
You know, it's funny. We had this discussion last night because my brother called me recently with the results of his DNA test. And a friend of mine at this, we went to a birthday party last night, and a friend of mine had just had hers done.
Like, you know, the 23andMe?
Yeah, like the 23andMe. I don't know exactly what they did, but that type
of
thing.
It's just a saliva thing.
And you know, my wife, the librarian, was saying, well, I worry about what they do with that information. Is it accessible to a health insurance company, for example, who could cancel you because they think you have a predisposition to one disease or another, or when you contract a disease, can they use it as evidence that you had a pre-existing condition before you got the insurance? I mean, as diabolical as that sounds, those are the kind of issues that we really need to discuss. And
so,
really,
Michael, let's just talk about how intelligent your wife is. The Golden State Killer, who was arrested here in California this week, his DNA confirmation came because a relative posted theirs to the global DNA thing, and the genealogy came through as a match.
Oh, my gosh.
His DNA that he left at a crime scene was a match on the internet. They went to his house. They got another collateral piece of information, which they said was like he sipped out of a soda can or he threw a paper cup away. It was a 100% confirmation, and they arrested him this week. He raped 51 or 52 women, and he killed 4 to 6 or 7, and he was a cop when he was doing some of it.
Yep.
And he's remained in obscurity since 1986, the last known crime that he committed. And yes, to Mrs. Brown's statement, that DNA got found out from that other website.
All right. I know you listen to the show, honey. So don't post your DNA. You don't need to connect it to any old crimes. But yeah, that's amazing. And it's fascinating, right? And so many people have been
relevant.
Yeah. And people have been gotten off death row, but this is by the same methodology. It's a shame that you have to think about things in those terms, but you really do, because information is power. And you know, when I worked for the Democratic Party, and we did direct mail, we were always trying to find out who had the potential to give us money. And we looked at all sorts of data. We looked at the magazines you read.
We
found out that, you know, people that read, you know, Ladies Home Journal were not as likely to give to us as people that read National Geographic. We would test them, and then we would use that information. So there are people out there, good people, that are gleaning information for positive reasons, and people that are, you know, doing it just for the money involved, gleaning whatever they can find. So,
And to your point, I think, and your wife's, is buyer beware.
Yes.
There is no such thing as privacy.
Yes.
Anything you publish, anything you type, text, say, is somewhere in the cloud or in the archives or what have you. Because my daughter used to do something on Snapchat, I think it was, they said it only lasted for 10 or 15 seconds. And then somebody hacked it and released it all. Just like that, there was that Ashley Madison, I think it was, the website. It was about married people cheating. And then somebody hacked it and released all the information, all those names of people who were registered users.
Right. And you know, that's another thing that Mrs. Brown preaches constantly to these kids, is that, you know, someday you're going to be 21 and they're still going to remember what you said on the internet when you were 13, but maybe you won't want to remember, you know, one of us, you know, didn't say stupid things when we were children that changed when we were adults. So that's really important. And we preach it in politics. We say, look, if you've ever had a traffic ticket or, you know, anything in your past, you need to get out in front of it in day one on your campaign, because somebody's going to find it and it's going to come out.
I learned that in campaign management school. So interesting that you've done that and I've done that. I mean, decades ago, that you got anything that needs to be known, let us know now. And then we'll have to figure out if that's a deal breaker or not. And you know who did it really well was the guy who was, he was on the TV show Tim Allen with the wife and the three sons. Home Improvement, I think it was.
Yes.
He got busted and was incarcerated for cocaine trafficking.
Right.
And when he got cast, he went full out with that. And so it became a non-issue or a non-story.
Right.
Because
you know,
it.
Right. And if people accept you for it, then they've accepted you for it, and that's it. You know, but if you get on the show and they find out at 10 episodes in, who knows what happens.
Exactly.
And you know what? It's funny. At the inauguration, I met him briefly, and he was a very sweet man.
Really?
And a big, big hero of mine, because, you know, my wife will tell you that's the kind of guy I am. You know, I'm a guy's guy. They were talking about going to high tea last night, and I was saying, you know, I'm just not a finger sandwich, you know, peg for kind of guy. Yeah, I want a big old honking piece of cheesecake,
hamburger,
that with a strip steak or something. But, you know, Look, I can't let this day end, this hour end, without asking you some questions, Joe, because you're such a fascinating person, and I don't think people know this about you. You were the executive producer of a sitcom pilot for NBC. Tell us about that. What was that?
So interesting that I – thank you. One of my cohorts, he's working on his dissertation, so he's a couple years ahead of me. He asked me too, and it made me go back in time, met with the then president of NBC, whose name was Ted Harbert, and did the story development, and then hired the writer to write the 23 minutes of dialogue, and he got $500,000 to do that.
Wow. And then sat, I'm in the wrong business.
Yeah, in all the casting sessions. And we had created a woman that was about 40-something that wasn't a sex symbol, but was a mother and a career woman. So we got these luscious women to audition for the role because it was kind of ahead of its time that, you know, you weren't just the bimbo or the right, perky-breasted blonde bombshell kind of thing. And then did the whole production. And unfortunately, something happened with the strong female lead, and her scenes were misedited, and the show didn't get picked up. And I'm not sure if the casting couch was rejected, because this was back in the day,
yeah,
or if she somehow upset somebody in the hierarchy, but her best moments were cut out, and therefore it didn't really have substance, and it didn't see the light of day.
Well, you know, as someone who's never really been involved in the entertainment business, but knows people that have been, I've seen, you know, I've seen people with incredible talent who have never really, you know, because of the way the chips have fallen or just because of luck or anything else. I have friends that are brilliant musicians, but, you know, they've all done other things to make a living because they could never make a living strictly at music. And, you know, I've known other people in the business who have had things that started and they just didn't get the breaks. Well, also tell us, this is something that I need to know. This is a personal thing. I should have asked you when you were here, but why did you sell your Harley?
So I bought my first one in 2006, June, and went to Sturgis in August of 2006 and broadcast my then Morning Drive radio program.
But
from
wait a
there.
Second, I have to ask you, did you drive from L.A. to Sturgis?
So that time didn't. Did the whole RV trailer thing right, because I got off the air on Friday at 10 a.m. and I had to be back on the air on Monday at 6 a.m.
Wow.
And so you can't get there doing other than in a, you know, motor vehicle. But I rode my Harley every morning 35 miles to the studio and then back, and then did all the rides that you do in Sturgis, which are amazing, Mount Rushmore and all of these fantastic sites. But the second time I went, which was in 2012, I did ride, and we rode 500 miles a day.
Wow.
And we did about 4,200 miles in 10 days. So it takes you about 5 days to get there, and then you're there, and then you know, back. And I was one of 10. I was the only female. It was 9 mostly retired LAPD motor cops, because one of them was my friend who invited me. They bunked up. I didn't, of course. And we would, you know, do our ride, and then we'd get into the next town right about 7 o'clock when the sun was setting. And we'd go to dinner, and then we'd have, is it called Knob's Creek or Maker's Mark?
Yeah, bourbon.
One of those two.
Yeah.
At the end of the night. And the men all looked at me, and they would always say, Maria, you know why you're here? And I'd say, no. And they said, because you're not married to any of us, because no wives are allowed. So I came back with my sporty 1800 low, and they said to me, you got to get a bigger bike. And so they made me go to the dealership, and I rode a Street Glide, which was the only other Harley that I had ridden. And they said, don't agree to anything. We're going to go to lunch, and then we'll talk about it. And so I said, okay. And so then the sales guy says to me, so blah, 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 blah. And I said, you know what? We're going to go to lunch. And then one of the lead guys said to me, let's have a sidebar here. And he goes, Marie, that's a smoking hot deal. Take it. And I said, I didn't come to buy a bike. I just came to ride a, you know, one that has six gears and a sound system and running boards and, you know, a windshield and creature comfort side bags that I didn't have on the Sporty. And he said, that's a smoking hot deal. So I bought that bike, a Street Glide, and I lived in a home that had a big, tall driveway, steep entrance, and I dropped her six times.
Wow.
It's going a big 0 mile. It's over 1,000 pounds. And once I could pick my Sporty up by myself,
yeah,
but not this one. So I'd have to wait for a neighbor to come by and offer me help and then, yeah, you know, put it in the garage. And I thought, no, this isn't fun. This is work. It's scary. It's so I sold that.
Well, and that's why I went in the other direction, because I had a Glide. That was my first Harley, was a Glide.
Oh, and really?
And now I have a Sportster because it was narrow framed, smaller, you know, little smaller.
It's much more agile, easier to get around.
And I made that transition because I in between the two Harleys, I had a bunch of big Japanese bikes like 750 Hondas and
stuff.
Did
you really?
Yeah, oh yeah, ride them.
I learned on the 750s. My dad.
Yeah, they're very cool. They're very cool bikes.
And very facile.
Yeah, and if I could get another one, you know.
No.
Once
a Harley, always a Harley.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, it's kind of a thing, right? And
being a female on a Harley in Sturgis, not being the passenger, wearing a hot pink helmet and my, you know, chaps and everything else with my blonde hair, I stuck out.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm not really comfortable with sticking out. Even in Southern California, we have got these iconic places that Jay Leno goes to and all writers go to, and it's nothing but a sea of chrome. And I didn't like sticking out. I felt uncomfortable.
Well, you know, you see more and more people. In a few weeks, I will go to the wall on my motorcycle on Memorial Day because we all ride to the Vietnam wall. Of 500,000 Harleys come into Washington. And
that's like a mini Sturgis.
Yeah, it is. It's like a mini.
I didn't realize it was that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's just not as big a deal because it's not as big a festival. You know, they come in and out. But you see a lot more women on bikes and not on the backs of bikes anymore, but driving them and driving Harleys. And, you know, that's an unusual thing. It's not just like a macho thing, but it's also the fact that a damn Harley costs 20 grand plus these days. So you got to be well heeled to be able to afford one. So it's an economic thing as well. But yeah, you see a lot more women on them. And for those of you that are listening that don't understand the enormity of this story that you just heard from Maria, 500 miles a day is a ridiculous amount of miles. And two, Sturgis, just in case you don't know about Sturgis is really motorcycle mecca. It's the place that every
guy. It's the single largest motorcycle rally in the world.
And it's the place that every person that owns a motorcycle wants to make at least one trip to Sturgis.
I made two.
I've never done it. And you know, that's certainly part of my dream. So, well, it's time to sign off with my most fascinating guest so far this year.
You're so sweet, Michael. Thank you. I don't think I've ever been interviewed.
Well,
I've always been the interviewer for decades.
There's so much more to talk about with you, too. We'll have to do it again. But next week, folks, I go to Portugal to talk about the American dream. So I will be back. Maria will be on. I'm not sure. Do you have a guest, Maria?
We're thinking Dr. Robert Holman.
And he would be a great guest. I'm sorry I would miss that because he's a Washingtonian, but I'm going to be in Portugal talking about the American dream.
You're making a big brush stroke there. Nobody knows what that means. You're talking about statehood.
No, I'm talking about the American dream with a Republican, actually, a senator from Maryland. And I think statehood just gets integrated into it because the American dream is really about liberty and justice and freedom and equality. And, okay. And those are all issues that I'm talking about. But I think, you know, I think that the American dream is basically that people came over and built this country on the idea that they could be free and they could work hard and they could attain and that they could have a better life and, more importantly, make a better life for their children. And I think the dream still lives on, and maybe it's a little different on the way we get there. But when I come back, I'll tell you what I said.
Okay. And okay. Why?
And why? Yes.
Yeah. And why?
All right.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, America. Now here's a song that Maria picked. She'll see you next week, and I'll see you in 2 weeks. Thank
you. In 2 weeks, yes.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.